This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the program that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, is traveling. Coming up, a new poll purports to show that African-Americans are satisfied, mostly, with the way they're living. But what does that mean, exactly? And who is pursuing the genocide case for the tens of thousands of blacks who are dead or missing in Libya? But first, President Obama has transferred Susan Rice from ambassador to the United Nations to national security advisor at the White House. The UN job would go to Samantha Power, who, like Rice, is a longtime proponent of so-called humanitarian military intervention. We asked Maurice Carney of Friends of Congo what the appointments mean to Africa in general and Congo specifically.
For Africa, it certainly should raise concerns. Those of us who are maybe Pan-Africanists are concerned about the welfare of Africa in general, because one can reasonably argue that the two most aggressive individuals on the intervention in Libya by NATO, which was in fact led by AFRICOM, were Susan Rice and Samantha Power. Their aggression was buttressed by a moral fig leaf, which you mentioned earlier, called R2P, or Responsibility to Protect, which basically argues that the U.S. and others in the global community can use military force in the name of humanitarian intervention. We know that the intervention in Libya was anything but that.
And what is this global community? I would assume that most people would think that it consists of more than NATO.
Yeah, it depends on the situation that you're talking about. I understand it's we've seen the U.S. use more specifically international community when it serves its interests. When it doesn't serve its interests, it drops it off the radar altogether. For example, we've seen in situations at the United Nations where the entire world votes against Israel aggression against the Palestinians, but yet the United States don't say that the global community position is that they stand on the side of the Palestinians. I know it's a vague term, but it's a term used by imperial powers when it serves its interests.
The African Union made some tentative steps to distance itself, at least, from the International Criminal Court, which specializes in indicting Africans. But Susan Rice has been a great advocate of the criminal court and indictments all around for people that the United States dislikes.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important, Glenn. I just want to get back to a few key issues. The United States, as you know, and your listening audience probably knows, is not party to the Rome Statute. It's a statute which formed the International Criminal Court. So it's rather bizarre to see the U.S. pushing for different individuals, particularly those they don't like on the African continent, to be brought before the International Criminal Court, when in fact it has allies that have committed mass crimes and possibly even genocide. And we're talking about leaders like Paul Kagame of Rwanda. His regime, its top 40 officials, have an international arrest warrant out on it by the Spanish courts under the principle of universal jurisdiction because of the crimes that these top 40 officials have committed in the Congo and in Rwanda. We have a situation where another staunch U.S. ally in the form of Yoweri Museveni, president of Uganda, who the International Court of Justice ruled against in 2005 for having committed crimes against humanity, war crimes, and looting of Congo's resources. So when these individuals who are proxies of the United States that carry out U.S. interests on the African continent, these individuals who stand firmly ensconced in the neoliberal push on the African continent, the U.S. is silent, not only silent, but run interference to protect them from any kind of accountability. So really this whole question of responsibility to protect, this whole question of humanitarian intervention, the Congo serves as a massive inconvenience for the likes of Samantha Power and Susan Rice, because we have a situation, for example, where the United Nations published what they called the UN Mapping Exercise Report in 2010, and it said that the crimes that were committed in the Congo by U.S. ally Rwanda, if these crimes were to be presented in front of a competent court, Rwanda could be tried for genocide in the Congo. Yet, we do not see the U.S., Samantha Power or Susan Rice, calling for any kind of accountability whatsoever when it comes to the Rwandan regime, which has invaded Congo twice and supported proxy militia in the Congo and triggered what the United Nations itself says is the deadliest conflict in the world since the Holocaust, since World War II. But yet, these R2Ps and the humanitarian interventionists such as Rice and Power have been not only silent on the crimes in the Congo, but they've protected the criminals who have committed those crimes in the Congo. So this is a major contradiction that light must be shed on.
There is now operating at some level in Congo a United Nations Intervention Brigade, whose mission ostensibly includes containing, through armed force if necessary, the so-called rebels that the international community, the real international community, has identified as actually tools of Rwanda, who've been virtually occupying much of the eastern Congo. That brigade was created through action by the United States and France. Do you think that this brigade can be trusted, given its origins, to actually move against M23/Rwanda in Congo?
Thanks for the question, Glenn. And I want to respond to you slowly, because it's really important for people to follow what is happening here. We have a situation where there's more light being shunned on the region, you know, through your reports, the Real News, Al Jazeera, others. So it's harder, it's more difficult for those committing the crimes, and they're well documented. We're talking about Rwanda and Uganda in the Congo, U.S. allies that are committing the crimes, to get away with it. So the U.S. has to do something to demonstrate that it's being responsive. And this is something that it's trying to do, or it's attempting to do. It's doing it while keeping the main structure, the structural forces that have caused the untold suffering of the Congolese people over the past 16 years to be perpetuated. They want to keep that structure in place. And that structure basically is there is a dictatorial network in the region that began in the Clinton administration and was perpetuated, continued in the Bush administration, and now in two Obama administrations, where strong men in the heart of Africa, we're talking about Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, Paul Kagame of Rwanda, and even Joseph Kabila of the Congo, being supported, sponsored by the U.S., either through arms, through training, through AFRICOM, through intelligence, the sending of military equipment. Kagame himself, just a few days after Obama was inaugurated, or around the time he was inaugurated in 2009, a shipment of arms went to Rwanda, for example. So the support that this dictatorial network is getting from the U.S. is still intact. Now, the U.S. would like us to believe that they're doing something. So they pushed at the U.N. for this peace framework, which does everything but call to account these dictatorial regimes, especially Rwanda and Uganda. So it's important for your listening audience to understand that this is an alternative that they're presenting to actually doing what they know could make a difference, which is to dismantle that dictatorial network, stop providing the arms, stop providing the training, stop providing the intelligence, stop providing the money to Rwanda and Uganda, who have waged a tremendous war against the Congolese people. So that's one element of it. So the peace framework is likely to fail. Very little could come out of it. However, there's another element that people may not be fully aware. When Ban Ki-moon went to Congo this past week, he didn't go alone. He went with the World Bank and its head, Jim Kim. And they brought a $1 billion package, ostensibly to give to the regional leaders so that they can make peace in the region. However, what this $1 billion package does is basically rewarding or further rewarding the criminals in the region. Because through the late 1990s and up to today, the Rwanda and Uganda have benefited from World Bank money, and they've continued to wage war against the Congolese people, as is documented documented in a Harvard Kennedy School of Government paper by Timothy Reed called Killing Them Softly, has four and eight to Rwanda and Uganda caused the tragedy in the DRC. So what we see here is an attempt through the World Bank with this billion-dollar gift, through the UN with its peace framework, to maintain the structures of oppression, the structures of conflict, the structures of economic exploitation and dependency in a manageable form so that it would be acceptable to the world and the world could say, well, we're doing something about the Congo.
Yes, and we must mention the basic fact that this conflict revolves around the resources of eastern Congo. The extraction industries are operating there still. They're paying no taxes to any government, although what they pay to Rwanda and Uganda for protection money is unknown. And that is a fundamental aspect of this conflict.
Without a doubt. And not just the question of the resources. It's really important, listening audience, to understand that these are strategic resources. The coltan is strategic. It's not just for your cell phones, but it's used in night vision goggles by the U.S. military. The cobalt is strategic. It's not just for the batteries in your cell phones or the color in your color television, but cobalt is vital to the U.S. aerospace and military industries. The coltan, again, is key for precision instruments and fighter jet engines. So we're talking about strategic minerals, just as Congo was vital for strategic minerals during World War II. The uranium from the Congo was used in the atomic weapon that was dropped on Japan by the United States. So we've seen a long history of the attempt to control the resources in the Congo by assuring that Congo is unstable, ungovernable, and that there's no leader that steps up, that controls the country and acts on behalf and in the interest of the country, as we were told by Larry Devlin himself, the chief of station for the CIA in the Congo, when he overthrew Lumumba, stated that we had to overthrow the Lumumba regime because it was acting against the interests of the United States. And if we did not remove this democratically elected leader by the Congolese people, not only would we have lost the Congo, but would have lost all of Africa. So this is how key the resources that are in the Congo are to the U.S. and its interests. How key the Congo itself is as a strategic country in the heart of Africa, bordered by nine other African countries, which is a region in and of itself. So this is really what's at stake, Glenn. Once you have a destabilized Congo, once you have a Congo that's not ruled by Congolese, not governed in the interests of Congolese, then you can have unfettered access to those resources, whether it's through the east from Rwanda or even through the west from Kinshasa with a pliant Joseph Kabila who acts and supports the interests of the west.
And yes, we've talked about Uganda and Rwanda and the United Nations and the United States and Congolese President Kabila, who seems subservient to the United States. But what of developments in Congolese civil society?
The civil society, particularly among the youth, are striving to change the situation in the country. As you know, it's a huge country, the size of Western Europe, and the young people going from province to province, educating the citizens about their role and responsibility in assuming leadership in the country, about what is at stake in the country. So there is a vibrant youth movement that is burgeoning in the country, but they're fighting against enormous odds because they're not only fighting against their own leaders, they're not only fighting against regional leaders, but they're fighting against global powers like the United States and the United Kingdom. And this is why it's vital and it's critical for ordinary people throughout the globe to act in solidarity with these young people, to serve as a counterforce to the foreign nations and corporate forces that are looking to control the enormous wealth that we find in the Congo.
And this is where Friends of Congo's Division of Labor comes in.
Without a doubt. If people would like to support the youth on the ground who are fighting for change, they should visit us at congoconnect.org. That's congoconnect.org. And they'll see what the young people are doing and see how it is that they can join in solidarity with these young people who are reaching out throughout the globe, especially the global south, to Latin America, other African countries, progressive forces here in the United States, seeking support because they believe that Congo, the Congo movement, is as important today as the Free South Africa movement was yesterday. Because once Congolese and Africans are in control of the Congo itself, it can transform the entire African continent. So this is just not a Congolese issue, but this is an issue for Africa as a whole and for people of African ancestry throughout the globe.
Maurice Carney of Friends of Congo, speaking from Washington. Dr. Francis Boyle is a renowned professor of international law at the University of Illinois at Champaign. Boyle is author of a new book titled Destroying Libya and World Order. He says the appointments of Susan Rice and Samantha Power are more bad news for U.S. foreign policy.
It's a matter of public record that the four people in the Obama administration, one, who pushed for the genocidal war against Libya were Secretary of State Clinton, her head of policy planning, Anne Marie Slaughtered of Princeton University, Rice there at the United Nations, now moving to become director of the National Security Council, and Samantha Power, who at that time was at the National Security Council and is now moving to become ambassador to the United Nations, assuming she does get confirmed. That position would have to be confirmed by the Senate. So the four of them, Clinton, Slaughtered, Power, Rice, were responsible for exterminating about 50,000 Libyans under the guise and pretext of this so-called responsibility to protect, which is really a reworked version of humanitarian intervention. And I go through all of this in my new book, Destroying Libya and World Order, that just came out. You can get it at Amazon.com with my analysis and citations there. And in particular, we saw outright genocide inflicted on the black citizens of Libya and black foreign guest workers. I had visited Libya quite extensively myself in the 1980s. There was substantial numbers of black Libyan citizens, and then Gaddafi had opened up Libya for work by black people from around Africa, refugees and whatever. And as we know, these people were exterminated. And I argued in my book this was outright genocide, to be sure, and that those in command of the situation under U.S. Army Field Manual 2710 were responsible for genocide in violation of the Genocide Convention and arguably the U.S. Genocide Convention Implementation Act. So that's pretty much what we're going to have here, running Obama's foreign policy forum to genocidaires, as we like to call them in the human rights profession. And it does not augur well at all for Syria. One was hoping, at least I was hoping, that we could see, in light of the fact that these rebel terrorists were just defeated at Qusair, a winding down of the war. But Rice and Power fully support this bogus doctrine of responsibility to protect humanitarian intervention and pushed it on Libya. And as I pointed out in the conclusion to my book, these are the same people who are now, will be pushing it, have been pushing it against Syria.
Clearly, humanitarian military intervention is a war-making mechanism. How was a concept with the word humanitarian in the middle of it transformed into a weapon?
Glenn, it's very effective propaganda. I have a whole chapter in my book, Chapter 5, dealing with the historical evolution of so-called humanitarian intervention from the late 19th century up through and including the Clinton war against Yugoslavia over Kosovo. By the way, Rice worked for Clinton, and she was involved in that, as did Mrs. Clinton. So it's the same argument, the same scenarios they used against Yugoslavia, Libya, and now they're using it against Serbia. So it's propaganda. There's no question about it. And it has always been propaganda. And now they have a new, since the other term humanitarian intervention was pretty discredited, they just renamed it as responsibility to protect, but it's still propaganda. And this doctrine was condemned by the International Court of Justice unanimously in the Corfu Channel case, 1949. And then again in the Nicaragua case, 1986. So it's completely bogus, but it's a good way for an allegedly neoliberal administration like Obama is supposed to be to deliver neoliberal support for what are imperial and neocolonial wars. It's sort of like preventive warfare doctrine for Bush trying to appeal to the neocons, and that going back to the Project for New American Century written by Wolfowitz and Pearl. So this is the propaganda for manufacturing consent by the neoliberals. That's what we're seeing. And Rice in power, Clinton slaughtered, all consider themselves to be neoliberals, and that's what neoliberals use to appeal to the left wing of the Democratic Party, mainstream Democrats, the news media, etc. And it's very successful. Obviously, it's more successful, I guess, than the Bush doctrine of preventive warfare, which didn't go over very well. So this is very successful. Notice how there's almost no dissent on any of the mainstream news media for Obama's covert war against Syria. And there was almost no dissent for his overt war against Libya, given in the name of humanitarian intervention, responsibility to protect. And most so-called neoliberal law professors hopped to it and supported what Obama did there and now what he's doing against Syria.
And we see that people in the so-called human rights movement, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, they also eat this up like candy.
That's correct. And they wouldn't support the Bush war preventive warfare in theory, but the human rights organizations all go for this doctrine of responsibility to protect. And so pretty much de facto, they're supporting these wars as well. Amnesty International, for example, had recently hired Clinton's right-hand hatchet person named Nosel, as their executive director. The board of directors of Amnesty International hired a neoliberal Clintonoid to run the show. So that pretty much gives you an idea. The human rights community, the so-called community, is behind this too. We also have to consider the Zionist agenda here, which cannot be lost track of, both against Libya and Syria, and the role that Israel and the Zionists are playing and have played to take out both Libya and Syria. And a good deal of the human rights so-called community in America are Zionists and are committed to Israel. So rather than come out and say this war is good for Israel, we need to destroy Syria because they've always stood in the way of Israel's hegemonic designs in the Levant. They say, well, you know, we need to promote human rights, and the best way to do it is to support these rebel terrorists, extremist fundamentalists, and to arm them. So the doctrine of humanitarian intervention, responsibility to protect, fits in very neatly with the Zionist agenda to destroy Arab states that have created problems for Israel in the past.
Back to the subject of Libya. We know that the all-black town of Tuwerga, which used to have 30,000 or so people, has disappeared from the map. But you use the word genocide and extermination. Where are the black Libyans who made up a substantial fraction of the population? We're not talking about migrant workers here, but black people indigenous to Libya.
That's correct. We just don't know where they are. We do know large numbers of them were killed simply because of the color of their skin. And killing people because of their race is genocide under the 1948 Genocide Convention. There's no question about it. In the World Court opinion in the Bosnia case, which I filed for Bosnia, The court ruled that what you need for genocide is only a substantial part of the people. And in the case of the blacks living in this town, we have no idea where they are. Probably large numbers of them are dead and the rest dispersed. And we really have no way to account for them, none. And this was all carried out by these terrorist groups, organizations, individuals, armed, equipped, supplied by the United States and the NATO states. This is worse than ethnic cleansing. In the Bosnian case, the World Court ruled that the extermination of 7,000 Bosnian Muslim men and boys at Srebrenica was genocide. So here we have maybe 35,000 missing, disappeared people, and certainly a fortiori, that would be genocide too. And indeed, when you have disappeared people, missing people, that's a continuing offense under international law until they are accounted for. But notice the International Criminal Court is not doing anything at all about it, even though they have jurisdiction to do something about it. And this gets back to the International Criminal Court basically being a white man's court. Sure, they have a black woman there now as the prosecutor, but as Frantz Fanon pointed out in his classic work that we've all read, this is a case of black skin, white mask. The International Criminal Court only goes after tin pot black dictators in Africa, while the wholesale murderers and killers and genocidaires in the United States, Britain, France, the NATO states, and Israel get off scot-free. The Bensouda pays no attention at all to them, nor did her predecessor, Moreno Ocampo. It's even become now clear to the black states in Africa that have called for the latest African Union condemnation of the ICC and recommending that the African states consider pulling out. I think they should. It's clear this is a case of he who pays the piper calls the tune. And here the ICC budget is paid for by Europe, Japan, and Korea, and that's it. And we know the Japanese are racist, too.
With regard to the missing black people of Libya, legally speaking, who has standing to bring charges of genocide? And specifically, how could Americans become involved in this issue?
Well, we do have that very famous case back in the early 1950s. I think the NAACP was involved and other black leaders. We charged genocide against the United States, and they filed a complaint with the United Nations over this matter. That could be done. They could file a complaint with the International Criminal Court and demand that Bensouda do something about it. But realistically speaking, I don't think she's going to do anything. He who pays the piper calls the tune. She's not going to do anything. But you can try, sure, for the record. It can be done. Indeed, the ICC does have jurisdiction. In the resolution, if you read it, the reference of Libya to the ICC by the Security Council does give the ICC jurisdiction to deal with all the atrocities in Libya, which would include genocide, although it hypocritically exempts states that are not parties to the Rome Statute, such as the United States. So as I argue in my book, basically giving the United States a green light to commit all the atrocities it wants to in Libya. But most of the European states are parties to the Rome Statute, and in theory, they should be investigated, prosecuted. But again, given the dynamics of the ICC, I just don't see Bensouda doing it.
Therefore, many of the NATO allies of the United States that participated in the overthrow of the government in Libya might be theoretically at least touchable by the ICC.
That is correct. And I point this out in my book, Command Responsibility. They armed, equipped, supplied, and trained these fundamentalist terrorist groups that inflicted acts of genocide against the blacks, not only at the town of Tuerga, but also black foreigners. They were just exterminated on site. Cynthia McKinney has a book on this with a whole chapter, I think, trying to compile what evidence there is. But again, we don't have all that much evidence, Glenn. I've looked for it. No one seems to want to come up with that evidence and investigate that evidence. They want to put it under the rug. Second, many of the Rome Statute states also have domestic implementing legislation for the Rome Statute, making Rome statutory crimes also crimes under their domestic law. So there might be remedies available in some of these European NATO states that did participate in this war of aggression and genocide against Libya.
Dr. Francis Boyle, professor of international law and author of Destroying Libya and World Order. A new poll by Harvard University and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation portrays black Americans as essentially satisfied with their lives. The survey says 86% of respondents claimed to be satisfied in 2013. 90% told Harvard pollsters the same thing back in 2002. We spoke with South Carolina activist and author Kevin Alexander Gray and asked him, what do the poll numbers mean, or do they mean anything at all?
Probably means Harvard needs to stop taking polls of black people. That's the thing that comes to mind. And you're not going to get too many answers out of Harvard on black people because W.E.B. Du Bois and folks like him aren't there anymore that know the right questions to ask and know how to measure well-being in the black community. We had spoken earlier, and we talked about growing up in the South or in areas where there was poverty, and people used to sweep the dirt in their front yards. They didn't have lawns, but they swept the dirt because they wanted to keep up appearances. And to them, that was a positive thing. So, you know, some of these polls are like sweeping dirt in a front yard. It doesn't really make your area any more cleaner. It just rearranges the dirt and kicks up a little dust.
And so this is a kind of purposeful optimism, a keep your head up, my life is not bad, I'm living it kind of outlook.
Well, I think liberal institutions want to keep liberal faith in other liberal institutions, including the presidency, including the government. And so to have them come out with these metrics of satisfaction is pretty self-serving or institutional serving. Because when you look at the real numbers in the black community, when you look at unemployment, which is in double digits, and we can only compare it to depression level numbers and a depression level atmosphere, although people go through a lot of cosmetic types of things. They buy cheap retail. They live for the facsimile of luxury. But when you look at real wealth, property ownership, income, savings, ownership of stocks and bonds, having property or things to pass down to your progeny, the numbers for black people just don't look good. Now, how people feel they have to deal with that, whether or not they have any kind of help at all, whether or not they're on their own, because we're living in the age where people are taught or it's beaten to their heads that if they're poor, it's due to some failing within them. You know, most people are in survival mode. That's the politic right now. There's no mass politic other than survival. But when you look at the real numbers, unemployment, the wealth gap, housing, prison rates, arrest rates, police abuse cases, what's happening in the schools, the numbers just don't bode well for black people. And what it's going to take to get some focus on how do we change the downward spiral of the black economic condition, well, obviously it's not going to be coming from institutions or coming from atop or on high. We have to figure out what the new grassroots movement is going to look like, and you have to organize movements like you organize, and with a few stalwarts at first, and you hope to build. And maybe we need to invest money in freedom schools to talk about how politics impact on people's lives. And maybe we have to do what people did in Jackson, Mississippi, and elect people like Chukwe Lumumba to office who have more of a revolutionary radical agenda. Maybe we need to protest more. But obviously there's something that needs to be done to change the trajectory of black economic fortune so that we're not so dependent on an underground economy which seems to be emerging in the black community.
And that is the point. All of the numbers that we know of are very bad for Black America, but there are some numbers that we don't really have a handle on, and that is the informal economy.
Right. And a lot of people don't want to talk about it because, as I said, we know that arrest rates for Blacks and whites for something as benign, in my opinion, as marijuana, is four times that of whites. Black folk are going to get arrested. That's evident with stop and frisk in New York City. That's evident with the amount of Black folk who are killed by police, one every 28 hours. Why are so many people in prison for nonviolent offenses? They're drug offenses. So there's something going on in regards to the Black community and its relationship with the criminal justice system. That's a wealth drainer that we never talk about. Those folk that go to prison, they get out, they can't really get a job once they get that felony on their record, or at least not a good job. So it's just a cat and mouse game. It's between those drug defendants, the lawyers, the court system, what you pay in fines, the police, what folks spend in money going back and forth to jail to visit relatives. It's a really bad system. It is a chattel system. How much inmates pay when they call home on these private phone services, prison labor competing with private labor and unions. There's a lot of things that go into this hidden economy or this not-so-hidden economy, drug economy, that's the interaction amongst people within a community and the interaction of people to the system at large.
You said earlier that maybe we should protest more. We, of course, remember that some time ago there was a culture of resistance, that it was right to resist, but that culture has not been fed and nurtured in recent years. Could people be responding to the counterculture to that, that is the dominant culture that says that you should be optimistic and get on with your life, and it really is not too social to go around complaining about your level of existence?
Well, you know, some of this is the age of Obama and the mass psychosis that Black folk are in. You just had to lay it where it's at, where people feel as though to express pessimism is to express pessimism in the first African-American president, in which they've cashed in, that is, Black folk, all their chits, it seems, to support this fella. And they're not going to make any demands on the system from the top to the bottom, where you've got radio personality and TV personality henchmen to keep there from being a discussion of politics and the politics of this particular president, to people like, I was on a radio show with Dr. Aubrey Hendricks, who was upset with me because I said I didn't trust government. You don't trust government? And that was all due to there being a Black president. You should trust government because there's a Black person or person of color that's running it, not anything that he is doing. So there's some of that going on, this idea of racial solidarity to support the country. Black folk have always been patriotic. Just look at how many wars we fought in and volunteered to fight in. So you've got people who have a need to be accepted and have a need to see what they believe is a personification of acceptance, not getting, in their minds, bombarded by the existing problems of empire.
What about the idea that Black folks have internalized the notion that if they're not doing well, well, it's their fault, and therefore don't respond to questioners in ways that would say that I'm doing badly or that I expect things to get worse?
Of course, Barack and Michelle Obama laid that personal responsibility rap at those two commencement addresses they made at Morehouse and, I believe, Bowie State. And it's all been par for the course for Obama since he was candidate Obama and talked about Black folk not eating cold Popeye's chicken or a good economic development plan would be for people to pick up paper in the neighborhood or to go into a Black church on Father's Day and call Black men boys. That's just his rap. But beyond that, that's an old rap. It's the rap or the detention between W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington. It's the tension between those of us who believe that the economic fate and fortune of Black folk are really tied to institutional racism, then the historical denial of access to capital and credit and Jim Crow and slavery. We believe that is structural. There are those that want to argue that it's behavioral. And those have been the two tensions in Black politics and in conservative neoliberal and radical politics since emancipation. And I don't think it's going to end, but those of us that believe that this country owes the descendants of the kidnapped Africans and the descendants of the discriminated against African Americans or black people in America, that slavery and Jim Crowism is the foundation of modern capitalism, that we demand that that debt be paid, just like Dr. King said, a promissory note that is yet unpaid. And instead of having these black politicians who would even, with the simplest public compact, like Social Security, attack it when the people who need help most when they get older, who pay the most into it and never get to use it, black folk, when we see that attack, that ought to be a wake-up call. If we're going to protest anything, we ought to at least protest for our future stability as old people.
United for a Fair Economy has calculated that it will take literally hundreds of years for black folks to achieve parity with whites in things like home ownership. And yet this poll says nearly 60% of black people believe that they will eventually achieve the American dream of financial security and of home ownership. Is this a healthy attitude to have an outlook on the future or state one that is at such variance with actual prospects?
Well, it gets back to the idea that who is doing the political education for people who believe that history doesn't matter anymore, that what has happened in the past doesn't matter, that the fact that there's global capitalism and corporatism that's stacked against you doesn't matter. There has to be something that we do in putting out our message and organizing at the grassroots level that help people understand the possibilities, not illusions, not cliches, not this Horatio Alger bootstrap garbage. And you're not going to get that from corporate media. You're not going to get that from mainstream politicians tied to corporate media and to Wall Street. You're not going to get that from the rapper who's tied to the corporation that exploits the people that buy the music. You're going to get this image of false luxury and the attainment of luxury as a driving force in people's lives, the attainment of things, instead of a politic that talks about economic sustainability and a politic and an economy that's anti-imperialism in its outlook, both internally and externally. So that's something that a movement, or at least a core building toward a movement, has to do. And it's long and hard work. It's not easy work, but that's the work that has to be done. The master is not going to help the slave free himself.
In other words, power concedes nothing without a demand, not a wish, a prayer, a hope, or a hip-hop riff.
And a struggle that goes with that demand. There you go. I mean, a hip-hop riff can change consciousness, but there's not a lot of hip-hop riffs out there that are really going after consciousness. What people are, you know, they're being sexualized, over-sexualized, or trivialization of sexuality, and the exploitation of misogyny and hypersexuality. And that's the culture. And of course, I'm old, so, you know, old folk have a tendency not to like young folk music, but you can still look at the content of music. And political music isn't popular, doesn't have a beat. What stations do you hear it on? So what has to happen, perhaps some of these kids that do the little mixtapes that they sell in the streets, like some folks sell dope, maybe they'll start having a political message that talks about what the police are really doing, how people are really living, how folk are living hand to mouth, how folk can barely afford to pay utilities, how they lost a house but now they're paying rent bills that are twice the cost of their house payments, how they can't get a particular job because they have that particular charge on their record. There's a lot of things that they could be talking about, and how it is that they got to do something other than go fight in a war to go to school. Those are the things that folk ought to be talking about. Some folk are trying, but we need more of it, and we need to figure out how we fund getting that word out, because you can't stand on the mountaintop and yell it.
That is, how do we get a movement that pays for itself?
Really, how do we get a movement that the people pay for instead of the corporations? That's the key. How do we get a movement where it's not all about somebody's pulpit and expanding their power in the pulpit or their personal political power? What is the new people's movement? I'm hoping that it's coming because, you know, people can't keep up a false front for so long. People can talk about being optimistic about the economy, but, you know, if you haven't worked in a couple of years, and that's another question, who did these people at Harvard poll? Did they go back and poll the long-term unemployed? Did they poll the person that had just lost their houses? I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of people that lost their homes. When was the last poll taken of them? Some of these kids that are engaged in fratricide against each other. Who's polled them? I don't know who they're polling. But I've never got one of them phone calls. From where I sit, people are tense. People are tight. There's an expanding internal economy where people are doing more bartering and working amongst themselves. There's also the drug economy that exists. And then there are the people that are making it the best they can. The ones that have to deal with the government, that have to deal with disrespect and whatever it is that the government puts in front of them to get the help they need. That's all going on. But people still have time to be happy and find joy in life, which is the other thing about these polls. Even though when things are hard, that doesn't mean that your life is without joy and happiness and you can't see in your kids' faces and in your grandkids' faces that there can be a better way. And that's what you tell your kids, that it's going to be better. You don't tell them it's going to get worse. You tell them to look for the best and fight for the best. And maybe it's the way the questions are asked in these polls.
Kevin Alexander Gray in Columbia, South Carolina. The overwhelmingly black metropolis of Detroit is under the virtual dictatorship of bankruptcy lawyer Kevin Orr, appointed emergency financial manager by Michigan's governor. Orr has his eyes on possibly selling Detroit's collection of precious artworks. Tom Stevens is an activist lawyer in Detroit. He says the plight of the Picassos and Monets has changed the political conversation.
Well, I think that so far, the public revelation that the priceless art at the Detroit Institute of Arts may be subject to some kind of move as part of this restructuring process that Jones Day and Orr and the governor are attempting to execute has made a huge difference in terms of the tenor of the conversation, the excitement of it, the temperature of the debates, and so forth. And so it's too early to say what the effect of that will be, but it certainly has the potential to increase resistance. And even as of today, in both the weekly alternative Detroit Metro Times and the smaller piece in the Detroit Free Press, it's pointed out that a bankruptcy judge generally does not have the power to seize and dispose of municipal assets in a municipal bankruptcy. So when Orr is talking about the BIA's art being at risk, he's apparently talking about selling it as part of a deal to somebody.
Yes, bankruptcy is, we usually think of as a protection. But in this case, with the introduction of an emergency financial manager and a different relationship to the state of Michigan, that protection seems to have been turned into its opposite.
The emergency manager and the governor have consistently said that they don't want to go to bankruptcy, but they're using it as a cudgel. And the question then becomes the cudgel against who? And the public answer is everybody. It's an incredibly complex process of wheeling and dealing and then litigating if necessary and using all sorts of power relationships and all sorts of legal, political, economic, and other resources and even violence, of course, different forms of violence, to get where one wants to go in a very non-transparent, to say the least, non-transparent manner. And that's what they call restructuring. I mean, restructuring Detroit, you know, is kind of a no-brainer. Of course you want to restructure a community that's suffered as much as this one has and that is on the ropes of this neoliberal economic catastrophe as much as this one is. But when it's being done in the way that Mr. Orr and his law firm and the governor are doing it, it raises a whole bunch of issues about justice that are just amazing.
One would think that the elected representatives of Detroit, specifically the city council, would be the first line of defense for the city.
Yes, one would think that. I mean, I think that it really comes down to your attitude towards power.
And unfortunately, you know, local elected officials are very willing to compromise with power if it means that they retain some of it.
Well, what power has the city council retained? They seem to be abjectly powerless.
All right. I think it's just a seat at the council table, still getting their salaries. Their real power, I think, is to justify what Jones Day and Orr and Governor Snyder are doing, because they can, Jones Day and Orr and Governor Snyder and the emergency manager fascist team, and sort of portray that, you know, they haven't changed it that much. Your elected officials are still in place and they're playing an advisory role. And that's why they're there. But at this point, I think they have a majority of the city council is willing to do anything they say they have to do. I mean, they approved the Jones Day contract as restructuring council. So I think at this point, within, you know, other, short of perhaps human sacrifice, they're willing to go along with pretty much anything that the emergency manager orders. They feel it's their obligation.
Developments at the recent African Union conference highlight the abject subservience to the West of the vast majority of states on the continent, and African leaders' occasional attempts to contest their subordinate status. On an independent-minded note, the African Union rebuked the International Criminal Court for its fixation on indicting only Africans for crimes against humanity. Ethiopia's prime minister, who was also chairman of the AU meeting, said the court's process has degenerated into some kind of race hunting rather than the objective of taking care of crimes and impunities. To drive home the point, the AU voted almost unanimously to ask the court to refer its case against Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and his vice president back to Kenyan courts, saying Kenya had the capacity to adjudicate the matter on its own. Only Botswana objected to the proposal. The ICC is known to eagerly indict just about anyone, any African that is, who falls out of favor with the United States. The U.S. clearly favored Uhuru Kenyatta's opponent in the presidential race, Raila Odinga, which may have been one reason that Kenyans voted the other way. Yet, the AU's slap in the face of the court, and indirectly its U.S. backers, is much less than it seems. Kenya remains an unwavering puppet of U.S. policy in the Horn of Africa, having joined in the invasion of neighboring Somalia at Washington's behest. And Ethiopia and Uganda provide the bulk of the troops occupying Somalia under U.S. direction. On paper, the war in Somalia is an African Union and United Nations mission, but the war is run by the CIA and largely financed by the Europeans. The African Union's little rebellion against the International Criminal Court simply shows that African leaders understand that the Americans have no loyalties and are capable of turning on any one of them when it suits their purposes, and having them tossed in prison by the International Criminal Court. The African heads of state were simply looking out for their own heads. There was a lot of bluster in Addis Ababa about creating an independent African force to maintain order on the continent. The leaders voted to create an intervening military unit to rapidly deal with crises and coup d'etats. That would be followed by creation of a full-fledged African standby force, a kind of continental standing army, as early as 2015. AU spokesmen speculated that the force could be 100% African in terms of men on the ground. However, it would still need logistical support from the so-called international community, a euphemism for the United States and Europe, who are, of course, the sworn enemies of African independence. The truth is, virtually all the armies of Africa, except for Eritrea, Zimbabwe, and Sudan, have become integrated into either U.S. or French military structures and cannot act independently. African leaders claim they will try to break free by raising taxes on things like airline flights and hotel rooms, but that's nonsense for home consumption. The African Union's Peace and Security Commissioner, Ramtane Lamamra, spoke of the historic nature and scope of the AU's tentative moves towards military independence, but they are parakeets in a cage, trying to sound like eagles.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. And while you're there, check out Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Giselle Hernandez.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.